We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Hello, everyone. I'm Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. On Perpetual Chess, I have weekly conversations with the chess world's best players, promoters, and educators about their lives, careers, current projects, and best practices. Perpetual Chess is brought to you through the generosity of its Patreon and PayPal supporters. For more information, go to perpetualchesspod.com. Hey everyone, and welcome back to another edition of Perpetual Chess. This is another adult improver edition for the uninitiated. What that means is we take a break from talking more holistically about chess and focus specifically on improvement, specifically on adult improvement. I know we've got a lot of chess enthusiasts listening, striving to get better, and we try to find guests who are in the same boat and can kind of point us in the right direction. So this week's guest definitely fits the bill. He's got a popular and fast-growing YouTube channel called Hanging Pawns. His name is Stepan Tomic. Stepan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Live from Croatia. And I'll just to give listeners a little bit more background, I'll read quickly the bio that you share in your YouTube channel, and you can let us know if that's totally up to date. You say, I'm a chess player who started his career late by any standards. I played my first rated tournament game when I was 26, 18 months ago. Since then, I've decided to dedicate my life and time to chess and make it possible to travel to tournaments and have enough money to do so. My ultimate goal is to work daily until I become a grandmaster, which will surely take years to accomplish. All the games I play, how I prepare for my opponents, and the methods I use to learn will be posted on this channel. Is that still accurate? Everything in there?
That's accurate, apart from the fact that it was more than 18 months ago now. It was 2.5 years ago now.
Yeah, I know how it is with updating the websites. Yeah, and your peak rating now is approaching 1900, so it looks like you're making good progress, and your videos on YouTube are fantastic. Shout out to Chess Reddit for making me aware of your presence. But yeah, you guys in Croatia, as we were talking a little bit before we started recording, you know how to do chess YouTube.
Yeah, that's probably a coincidence. I'm not sure, because before Antonio, aka Agad Mator, started, nobody really did YouTube in Croatia, not only in chess, but in general. And after he started, there seemed to be a growing popularity for chess and for YouTube as well. So hence, I'm here.
Yes, and the chess world is better for it. So you talk about, you obviously... comes across quite clearly in your videos. You've got a burning passion for chess and you're working really hard on it. But before we get to that, could you tell us a little bit more about where you're from in Croatia and how you discovered chess?
I'm from Zagreb, Croatia. That's the capital. And the story about how I discovered chess is actually funny. About 3 years ago, I was doing my master's degree in Poland and I was trying to get a PhD there. And when I was there was a bar called I Hate Mondays, where people used to play chess on Sundays. And I started playing with the guys there. I knew the rules of the game. And after I came to Zagreb, I wanted to start playing chess. And I Googled chess clubs Zagreb online. I found two websites, which were made in the 90s, probably. And I found one. Sorry?
No, sorry. You go ahead.
Yeah, I found one address from a local chess club in Zagreb. I came there and it turned out to be an Italian company. They just blew me off. There was no chess club. And after that, I was walking through one of the main streets in Zagreb and they knew that the Chess Federation was there. So I passed by the door. There were two guys in front of the building and I said, "Do you play chess here?" They said, "Yeah." And they came upstairs and there were 50 people playing a blitz tournament and I felt like a kid in a candy store. I just couldn't believe it. And ever since then, I just wanted to play chess throughout the whole day. And basically, I met a guy who became my coach. I joined the club he was the president of and we started working together. So that's the story.
Yeah, so just discovered it by happenstance, and like a lot of us, you were sort of bitten by the bug. It sounds like chess is pretty popular there in Zagreb relative to the population. I know that it's not, you know, Croatia is a pretty small country.
Well, Croatia is a pretty small country, but Zagreb makes up for the quarter of the population. And I wouldn't really say that chess is popular. People have been working on popularizing the game, but I'd say there are about 500 chess players in Zagreb, which is a pretty small amount considering the population. But I would say it's becoming more and more popular. Yeah.
Okay. And so once you discover the game, oh, by the way, what were you studying in Poland? What was your master's in?
I have a master's in medieval archaeology and I do Slavic studies, basically burial rites among Slavic peoples.
Wow. That sounds pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I'm interested in that, but we'll stick to chess. So once you're bitten by the bug and you have a coach, how do you take it from there? Like, I saw your first rating on FIDE was, I believe, in the neighborhood of 1700, but had you been, was that sort of your initial strength, or had you done some work even to get to that rating?
No, well, the story is that when I discovered the club and joined the club and started playing chess, it was late February of 2016, and I played my first tournament in May, and I didn't really want to play the tournament. It was actually the Team Cup Finals, Croatian Team Cup Finals, which is a very strong tournament, and you play it on four boards. Boards four are usually 1900 or 2000. And 2 days before the tournament, Mate, my coach at the time, called me and said, "Do you want to play the Chess Cup?" And I said, "Yeah, why not?" I've never played a tournament game. I knew basically no theory. I hadn't really been preparing my opening repertoire and I was studying the strategy and positional chess and tactics. And we came to Mali Lošinj, which is an island in Croatia. And I was one guy that should have played couldn't come. And I basically turned up as a substitution. I played six games and I scored half a point out of the six games, hence my rating of 1693 as an opening rating. But in round one, I just lost horribly. In round two, I was a knight up and had a completely winning position against the 1950 and managed to get checkmated. Round three, I drew, and then unluckily, I lost the other three games. I could have had a slightly bigger opening rating. If I had won round two, it would have been around 1900, I believe. But yeah, perhaps it's good that it turned out to be so small because I got to progress up to where I am now.
Well, you say that it's small, but for someone who's playing their first tournament, I actually think that that's pretty strong. Had you been working on your chess much building up to that? Had you already read a fair amount of books and stuff like that?
No, by that point I haven't read a single book, and I was just trying to understand the game because my perception of chess before February 2016 was, oh, that's a fun game, and I played it once or twice with one of my best friends when we were out, and in February I started taking the game seriously, and I didn't really want to put any dogmas in my head yet or any subjective opinions which the chess writers might have. So I started looking at the board and thinking about chess for the first 2 months, and I started to think about openings before I knew any theory because I wanted to figure out what the principles were for myself. And I was basically forced to learn theory in May. Otherwise, I would have taken another three or four months just to help me understand the game.
Gotcha. Yeah, it's good that you had that perspective. I often tell people that the chess in its purest form, to me, there's nothing more beautiful than when you discover it and you haven't read anything about it, because then you're forming the ideas yourself, and they might be, you know, in my case as a kid, of course, the ideas were quite flawed, but, you know, I remember thinking that I discovered fianchettoing a bishop, you know, and there's no substitute for that feeling, like, oh, you try something and it works, and you try something else and it doesn't work, and you sort of start to formulate a strategy, and then you get your first book, and it's like, oh, wait, I have absolutely no clue what I'm doing.
Yeah, yeah. But the difference is that, obviously, I was 26, so I knew that I will be surprised, and I took that road because I wanted to, and I didn't want to burden my mind with all of that before I made the mistakes myself, if you know what I mean. I knew that there was tons of tear behind the game, but I didn't want to do any of that before I understood it. Basically, I had no time to understand it, but yeah.
Right, good for you. And it seems like with an academic background, maybe you had good training for thinking about how to study something.
Well, the thing is that when I decided to play chess seriously, I thought about one thing: what advantage does a child have over me? And basically, anybody who becomes a grandmaster these days has started playing chess when he was 5. And the only advantage they have over me is that they have an empty head and they don't have to worry about stuff like money or education or my girlfriend or my parents or whatever. So, and my brain should be equally good as theirs, if not better, because it's fully developed. So I couldn't really find the downside. And I realized that the only thing I need to do in order to get better at chess is to clear my head of other things. So, yeah.
That's an interesting perspective. I would say I mostly agree, especially because you're what, 28 years old, is that right?
I just turned 29.
29, okay. Yeah, and you know, I mean, the research I would say on this is somewhat unsettled, but it looks like in terms of the brain studies that have been done, they think that a chess player peaks around 31 or something like that. You know, who knows? I mean, I don't think it's hard to isolate all of the circumstances, but I mean, anecdotally, it does seem that it gets a little harder on certainly south of 40. But lucky for you, you're still young and energetic, with most of your brain cells intact. So once you do decide, okay, this is something I want to take seriously, and once you are cracking books and formally studying, how do you structure your study plan?
Well, I basically made a 9-year plan for chess.
Holy crap, that's impressive.
Yeah, I made a 9-year plan, and at the end of year 9, I'm supposed to become a grandmaster. And I decided not to worry about rating until I reach the FIDE Master title, and I just wanted to learn as much as possible. And then the next thing I had to do is I needed to structure my working hours and what I did for money, because that's a huge issue when you're my age in Croatia. And the main thing I needed to do was try to put aside enough time for chess every day. So I basically did a plan according to which I'm going to study between 1 and 4 hours every day for the next 9 years, which should amount to enough time to become a grandmaster eventually, because everything I did research on indicated that I won't be needing more than 40,000 hours. Yeah.
That's interesting. So did you read a lot of the sort of peak performance literature?
I read a lot of psychology, because I thought this would be the most relevant, because usually people will stop improving on something because of a psychological problem. So I wanted to get that out of the way at start. And I started working on how to deal with defeat. And I basically started reading Stoicism to help me improve, because I thought it was the most important thing. I structured my chess training as well, obviously, but I wanted to get rid of all the possible obstacles before they appeared in front of me.
That's good perspective on your part, and I know that you did a good YouTube video about how to deal with defeat, so I'll link to that in the show description and people can check it out, and maybe we'll circle back to it in a few minutes. But
sure.
One question I had for you is, so we're about 3 years into the 9-year plan by my math. Have there been any moments yet where you felt like abandoning it?
Yeah, but not really because of chess. The thing is that in order to be able to play more and become a grandmaster, I need to free up my time. And the biggest part of my plan is becoming financially independent and not having to work for a living. So the thing is that if you want to become a grandmaster, once again, coming back to children who play chess, if you're 9 years old, then you can play 2 tournaments a month and you don't have to worry about money nor your time. And on the other hand, I need to work for 50 hours a week and I need to have money in order to go to tournaments. So I wanted to give up sometimes because of that, because it felt like it's too hard. Yeah, not because of chess. I really struggled with defeat at start. I almost cried once. I did cry once, and it was rough, but I never thought of giving up. The only time those thoughts came to my head was when I thought it's going to be too hard to have enough time and money to play chess.
Yeah, I mean, 50 hours a week working and a YouTube channel and your actual chess and a girlfriend. that sounds like a lot. But tell us about, I mean, not to harp on such a dark moment, but I mean, we can, I think everyone can relate to chess making you cry. So let's hear the story. What happened?
But it's the game I already mentioned, game 2.
In the video,
the
okay,
tournament.
Yeah.
No, it's the, oh. no, in the video, but... When I played the Croatian Chess Cup, my first tournament, I was playing a 1950 opponent. I was a knight up. I outplayed him in the semi-slav, even though I misplayed the opening a bit. And then I was basically a piece up. I just had to convert. I had a winning tactic, -6 or -7. And I didn't even miss mate. I just let him mate me. And after that, I was crushed because I basically lost 2 of my games at the start of my career, and I should have won game 2. So I was devastated.
Yeah.
and the thing is that nobody really understood what I was upset about. Another thing is that once you start doing anything when you're a child, you get used to it, and I wasn't used to it.
Yeah. I mean, it takes getting used to, but it never completely goes away. I mean, for me, I don't get to compete that often, but the visceral reaction is the same. It's more that I have sort of built the sort of, layers. I have the layers in place to sort of realize that it's not that big a deal. When you're a kid, I think that's harder. And that kind of dovetails into a question that was sent in from a supporter of the podcast, Bradley. Sorry, Bradley, I'm about to butcher your name, but we're going to try it. Bradley, you Perry or Juo Perry, I apologize. I don't know how the J-U-O is pronounced. But anyway, question from Bradley, and thanks for the support, Bradley. He says, as a fellow adult beginner who played their first rated game at age 35, what hurdles or thinking processes are unique to adult beginners versus kids making the rating climb? For example, my chess coach mentioned he finds his scholastic students playing too aggressively while I play too passively, overreacting to empty threats.
Huh. Well, is that a question or a statement? I think it's a statement because, and I think it's fairly obvious why. I mean, you've been through life already.
Right.
And there's nothing more to it. I mean, you have a different thinking process while playing the game, and you're aware of dangers that young players aren't aware of. I would say that's the case most often. And as an adult, you take the game much more seriously if you do take it seriously, and then you aren't willing to risk as much as the kids are.
Yeah. I mean, and it's a similar dynamic to just like, you know, I have my younger kid is going to turn 3, and obviously left to her own devices, she would just like sprint into the street, you know?
Yeah.
So the corollary for chess is just like, you know, kids just... They just want to attack for the most part. I mean, and I'm a chess teacher, so I see it a lot. There, of course, are kids with a more conservative instinct, but it's the exception rather than the rule, I would say. So, yeah. I think that's spot on. And in terms of thinking processes that are unique to adult beginners versus kids making the rating climb, I don't know. My personal perspective is maybe there's more self-doubt. I think, I don't know.
I would say that there's less competitiveness among adults. Obviously, if you're a child starting out chess, then you are going to have classmates and clubmates and whatever. There's going to be 20 of you who are going to be competing against each other, and you're going to have a lot more people to compare to. And as an adult, you're going to be the only one. I mean, I'm probably one of the very few people who've started playing chess this late in Croatia, and I have nobody to compare to. It's really hard. So I think that you shouldn't really look at your rating if you're a late beginner. You should just focus on beating yourself every day.
Yeah, that's good advice. Okay, so we're going to get into the meat of talking chess improvement now, Stepan. So, by the way, you did a great video that I'll also link to that I think pretty much it kind of synthesizes what we're looking for. You have a video called How to Study Chess Meditations, and yeah. I want to talk about YouTube channel later, but you know, you do a good job of sort of synthesizing what you believe to be the most important practices. But the way we usually tackle it here on the Adult Improvement Series is, we're going to discuss a few ways to study, and you're going to give me your opinion about how useful they are or are not on a scale of 1 to 10. So sure. You mentioned you had a coach earlier, and I don't know if you do now, but on a scale of 1 to 10, how important do you think it is to have a coach?
Chess-wise, if you train regularly, it's very important. I'm not that fortunate, and we only manage to meet once a month or even more rarely. And psychologically, it is very important. I would say psychologically is probably 7 out of 10, and chess-wise, if you train regularly, 8 out of 10. If you don't, then 1 out of 10. But it's very important to have the support he could give you or she could give you. And I would say that's extremely important, because as an adult, when you're studying something and doing something new, nobody really cares. So to have a coach when you are 29 or whatever, it's fascinating. And my coach is younger than I am. He's actually 24 now. So I feel like somebody cares for me.
Yeah, it is important, and it's such a solitary pursuit that it's almost like, even if they just function as a psychologist, I mean, that alone has value. And for listeners I think a lot of you may have coaches or at least have explored it, but of course there's all the great guests we've had on the show, but I also just wanted to mention that Lee Chess and chess.com both have coaches pages, and you know, they're not that expensive, but here in the Skype age to get a Skype coach, so I think it's definitely worth doing if you're serious about your chess, as you are. Okay. Yeah. Next up, analyzing your own games.
Oh, 10 out of 10. There's probably nothing more important, in my opinion, because the only way to improve is to correct your mistakes, and if you don't analyze, you won't find them. I think it's crucial, because especially if you have a narrow opening repertoire, by analyzing your own games, you're going to improve rapidly, and you're going to find ideas which you normally wouldn't. And I think one of my favorite methods is to look at my own game, find the first mistake or the first inaccuracy or the first inaccuracy in the opening, and then take 10 Grandmaster games from the same position and write an essay on why they played what they played and why did I make my mistake. And I think that helps a lot, and I've found my opening repertoire has solidified a lot because of that. Yeah, so I would say this is the most important thing.
That is an awesome idea that I've never heard before, because, yeah, the act of writing down your thought process, I mean, it kind of makes an indelible print. Did you come up with that idea on your own?
Yeah, I did. And it also makes it easier to prepare for games, because if you see an opponent, let's say I play the Semislav, and I'm preparing for an opponent who plays E3, and then queen to c2, then I'm going to take my essays out and read which mistakes I've made in the last games, and it's going to be much easier to correct them.
That's really a great idea. And do you use engines when you analyze your games?
No, I don't. I only turn it on at the end of my analysis, and then that's another essay I will write most often, and then I will tell myself where I went wrong, even though I thought about it for an hour, and that's where the engine comes in. Otherwise, I don't use it.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's a good approach as well. All right, Online Blitz, what do you think?
I think I shouldn't play it as much. The problem is that I use online Blitz the way I used Seinfeld before as something to relax me, and then I will just play a game not thinking about it, lose it or win it and not care. But I actually think it makes your chess stagnate if you play too much, because you will rely too much on your intuition and you will not improve. If you analyze every single Blitz game you play, then okay, it might be a great learning method, but I don't, and I don't have enough time for that. So I would advise people not to play Blitz chess if they want to improve. It could be in your free time. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's good. That's good advice. I mean, yeah, it all comes down. It's garbage in, garbage out. If, like, we had a guest, Alex King, who treats his Blitz games almost like tournament games. I mean, he has rules in place for when to analyze, for analyzing the games before playing another set, or at least making sure he analyzes all the Blitz games he plays within a week. And it's really a good way to build out your opening repertoire. But like you say, if you're just passing time, time is a pretty precious resource. So of course it's fun, but it's probably good to have some personal rules in place.
Yeah.
Watching elite tournaments online.
If you don't play the game over the board and think about the moves, then I would say 2 out of 10, because you don't get involved. But if you analyze the game along with the players, then it's very useful, and it can be as useful as analyzing Grandmaster games.
So it all comes back to active versus passive learning.
Yeah, I mean, if you watch the game in bed on YouTube, then I mean, you won't get much from it, but if you have your board next to you and you write down your ideas and think about the opening, then it's very useful, obviously.
Yeah. Okay, next up, studying openings.
Up to some point, 10 out of 10. Afterwards, 1 out of 10. I believe that everybody should build a narrow repertoire which could get them past the opening phase and make sure that they don't lose in the first 15 moves. After that, I would say strategy, positional chess, tactics, and the end game are way more useful.
Yeah, that's good. That's interesting to hear, because I noticed you had a lot. You've got a lot of YouTube videos on openings, but is that more? Is that more done from a sort of a content creation perspective, or is that based on work that you're doing for your own game?
Well, actually, my repertoire is very narrow, and I only play the Caro Kann against d4. I play the Semislav or the Grunfeld against d4. I play the c6. I play c6 against the English and d5 against knight to f3, and I only play e4. But I wanted to record every single opening in chess, because when I started playing chess, I went to YouTube as my first resource, tried to find some opening videos, and I got very upset, because everybody either talks for an hour about nothing, or the videos are too complicated, too in-depth, or too simple. So you can either get a 1,000 rated video for players who are rated 1,000, or a Grandmaster video, which are both useless for players of my level, or you can listen to something for an hour and not get anything out of it. So I wanted people to have a simple 20-minute video in which they are going to see what the opening is about, and that's it. I'm making all of these videos because I'm frustrated, and I want people to be happy when they write down, I don't know, Austrian attack in the Pirates. They see the variation, and that's it. They don't have to listen to me talk about the weather or whatever, and they can just get on with their lives.
That's interesting. Like I said, I definitely am eager as a content creator myself to talk about your YouTube channel, and we'll get back to that, because I think you're onto something. But next up, in terms of how important it is for chess improvement, what about exercise, Stepien? What do you think?
I think 10 out of 10. I basically, when I started playing chess, I've been on and off exercising, but for the most part I've exercised regularly, and I lost weight, not a lot of weight. I was never fat, but I'm in great shape now, and I only do it because of chess. I wouldn't normally. So I believe it's very important to stay fit, because when you're sitting over the board next to a guy who has 200 pounds and you're fit and you just ate broccoli and he just had 4 hamburgers, then you're going to win regardless of your play. So if you can get an advantage over your opponent, then you should.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny how many guests we've had who they exercise like specifically because of chess, which is...
Well, it should. I mean your games can last 5, 6, 7 hours. And I work for... with everything combined, I have to be active and working for 16 hours a day. And I find that if I'm not exercising for 2 or 3 weeks, then I can't really do it. And I have trouble resting and I have trouble working. When I'm exercising regularly and eating healthy food and doing everything right, then I'm up for 16 hours every day working and I don't feel it. I'm never tired. So it's very important, not only for chess, but to improve at chess.
Yeah. I'm really going to have to pull out the Excel spreadsheet when this interview is over and add up your time, Stepien, because I don't know how you do it. You're exercising too.
I can describe one of my working days to you. I wake up between 5:30 and 6, then I drink tea or whatever, a shake, and then I exercise until 7:30 or 8, then I shower, go to the office, I work. Then I come home or stay at the office, and from around 5 to 8 p.m. I record my video and prepare for it. I will be done around 9 perhaps, and then I work on my chess, and then I go to sleep.
Sounds like you got an understanding girlfriend.
Yeah, she's wonderful, and we've actually had a conversation the other day. I said that I overheard somebody say somewhere on YouTube that chess players are really hard to be with, and I can completely understand that.
Yeah. Luckily,
we work together, so it's okay. We see each other, and we're together for 8 hours a day, so you can't really feel that. But if we worked in different companies, then it would have been really rough.
Yeah, that I'm sure that does make a difference. Yeah, and I'm certainly I've had chess players email me and say, you know, does it cause a strain on your relationship? Which, yeah, I mean, certainly we've had guests who've had that issue.
It's hard to understand this obsession. I mean, the same way I can't understand how somebody can not be obsessed with chess.
Right.
It goes both ways.
Okay, next up, studying endgames.
Very important and endless. Even though it seems finite, it's really not. And I would say that once you grasp the basics, I don't know, the knight and bishop checkmate, the Lucina position and all the other, the rule of the square and the normal stuff you get in every chess book, then you should play at least one rook and pawn endgame a day just to give yourself enough practice, because I don't know, rook and 3 against rook and 4 can never be mastered, and grandmasters, 2800 players mess it up sometimes, so it should be practiced constantly just to keep yourself in shape. And I would say it's 10 out of 10. If you manage to survive until an endgame, and basically most endgames are resolved, and if you were a computer, you would know whether it's a draw or a win. And if you're not able to assess that position correctly, then you are just going to lose.
Yeah, that's good advice. So where do you get the position for the rook and pawn endgame that you practice each day?
I just take any random game. I just look at the games that were played the previous day, wherever in the world, whichever rating, and I will just take 2 or 3 endgames which seem interesting and analyze them, try to play them out myself.
Okay. And what about studying Grandmaster games generally?
I'd say that's very important to get ideas and to improve your chess in general, but there are more useful methods. I would say 8 out of 10 or 7 out of 10. It's really fun along with being useful, so it makes it one of the easiest training methods. And you can discover a lot of things which you couldn't on your own, so that's what makes it great. If you study openings with an engine, then you are not going to have any ideas at all. If you study the opening by yourself, then you're going to be playing bad openings. And Grandmaster games can help you get ideas which the engine wouldn't necessarily recommend. That's the great thing about their games. And in the middle game, you're going to be able to memorize patterns and improve your pattern recognition, which is going to help you when you play your own game. You're going to suddenly think of something you saw in a game half a year ago, and you're going to play a great move.
Yeah.
So I think it's very important.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, and I saw you mention this in your video, but you might as well share it here. What do you think about watching online videos?
Once again, if you don't do it actively, pausing the video and analyzing positions, it's almost useless, and it should be something you do in your free time. Because if you're not if you're not studying along with the video, nothing will stick really. And it's as if somebody were telling you a bedtime story. You will remember something, but you won't really understand stuff. And I think if you do watch online videos, and I have a YouTube channel, so I trust me, this is true. You can watch 5 hours of online video and not get anything out of it. On the other hand, you can watch a 10-minute video, analyze along with the video for an hour and become 20 rating points better. So I would say YouTube videos, if you just play them out and fall asleep, 1 out of 10. If you play over the stuff that somebody is analyzing over the board, then it varies. It could be 10 out of 10, depending on the quality of the video.
Yeah, okay. Excellent. All right, so that wraps up the facets of the game, the ways to approach studying. And again, I'll just, for listeners, I mean, you should check out, I'll link to your How to Study Chess video, but I'm just going to read your bullet points just so listeners can sort of have a holistic view of your approach. So you say number one, analyze games. Number two, solve tactical and positional problems. Yeah, we forgot to discuss tactics, so we'll get back to that in a second. Number three, read books and analyze along with them. Number four, study the end game and solve problems. Number five, study openings and build a repertoire. Number six, play practice games and analyze them afterwards. Number seven, play blindfold chess. And number eight, watch chess videos and analyze along with them. So I don't know how I missed it, but what about tactics? Like, how are you approaching those?
Try to solve as many as possible, basically. I think it's one of the most efficient methods to improve a chess, because it will improve your chess in general, and solving endgame tactics is going to help you, your middle game and your openings. You're going to develop a feel for strategy and positional chess as well, because if there's a tactic in the position, you are going to be able to become aware of it sooner if you've solved many tactics. So this should definitely not be overlooked. And if I had time, I would solve 100 a day, because I see that they are improving my chess rapidly.
Right. And do you primarily use tactics trainers or books or what?
Whatever I can get. My favorite method is that I try to look at Grandmaster games, and I set them on move 20. And I try to look for tactics. And one out of every 20 or 30 games will have something interesting. I usually pick move 20 as a random move in the middle game. And very often I will find tactical opportunities which the players have missed. I obviously use games from players rated in between 1900 and 2300, not super grandmaster games. And if I don't have time for that, then I will just go on Lee Chess or on chess.com or use tactic books.
Okay. Sounds good. All right. Piggybacking off of that, let's talk about resources. So we have another, by resources, I mean like your favorite study tools. So we have another question from a supporter of the podcast. It's a two-part question, but I'm just going to read the second part now because the other part has to do with your YouTube channel. So we'll get back to it later. So sure. This is from Daniel Gell. He asks, do you have any book recommendations on puzzles for calculation? I'm trying to improve that area of game, so I'm curious which resources you use. So you mentioned the tactics trainers. Are there any specific books you would highlight?
No, when it comes to calculation, I would definitely have only one recommendation, and that's Think Like a Grandmaster by Kotov. That's nothing will improve your calculation and your tactics better. I think that, well, have you read that book?
Many years ago, yeah.
Okay, so he basically explains how to calculate and how to approach the position correctly without wasting too much time or pondering about the position generally without really making any progress. So when it comes to calculation, his book is just a gem which you shouldn't miss. And yeah, and tactics, I don't really remember the names. They're basically called chess tactics or chess tactics from the Sicilian or whatever. There are hundreds of books and they're all good. You can't really point one out because they're all the same. They use tactics from real games. Just make sure that you get a book which isn't 20 years old when they didn't have engines, because sometimes there could be mistakes there.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. And Daniel, there have been some other recommendations. Like, of course, we've had a couple guests highlight the CT Art DVDs, which are kind of a nice way to go through. And if I recall, Daniel's like similar to your level chess wise.
Okay.
Beyond that, there's the Mikhail Block Classics, which you mentioned. There might be a couple errors in that one, but I mean, it's a lot of grandmasters have put in their time with that book. So, and the John Nunn chess puzzle book is pretty challenging. but good. There's just so many. And of course, I know that I think it was Vinesh Ravuri, another adult improver guest. He was not as big a fan of tactics trainers as tactics from books. But I think as long as you treat them seriously, either one is good. All right. Yeah. So you mentioned in one of your videos that you read about one chess book per week. So we got to get some other book recommendations from you, too. What would you recommend besides Think Like a Grandmaster?
Well, definitely My System by Aaron Nimcovich. So everybody should read that book. I would recommend Talbot Winnick 1960. That's a wonderful book. The Meran and Anti-Meran and Moscow and Anti-Moscow by Alexei Drev. Not because you have to necessarily play the Semislav, but because Alexei Drev really has an interesting style and he can help you understand the opening well. There was one book I read, The Rules of Winning Chess by Davis, in which he wrote a novel on how to go about preparing for a game from start to finish. Dvoretsky Sand Games, definitely. One more, which I shouldn't miss. John Nunn's middle game book. It's called Understand the Middle Game or something like that. A bit lower level. Yasser Seyravan's middle games. It's called Winning Middle Game Positions or Winning the Middle Game. Attack with Mikhail Tal. Have I mentioned that one?
No. Yeah, and if you don't mind emphasizing lower level a little bit more, because I do feel like sometimes I neglect the sort of below 1500, 1600 set. I think that we end up with a lot of high level recommendations, but not as many. So when you first got into chess, which books help you the most? You mentioned My System, and that one comes up a lot, although it's not my personal favorite. I find it too dry. But what else helped you?
Even Sokolov's Winning Chess Middle Games, it's a weird choice perhaps, but he basically went on to explain many doubled pawn positions, which helped me a lot. Concise Chess Middle Games by McDonald, that's a great one. My Great Predecessors by Kasparov, obviously. 60 Memorable Games by Fischer helped me a lot. I think My Great Predecessors would be a great book for beginners. Because it's great to learn chess trivia along with chess, and that might help you improve. I read one book. I read Silman's books. I read his complete book of chess strategy. That helped me a lot. There was a book called Grandmaster Preparation. I'm not sure what the author was. I think it's Hansen or something, Danish or Scandinavian. It was called Grandmaster Preparation. It's a great book. I can't remember anymore. I'm sorry. I've also read tons of opening books on the Karo Kan and the Semislav.
So, listeners, you can tell that he's not bluffing when he says he reads an opening book a week. That was an impressive array of recommendations, and I'll link to them all in the show description, so pick and choose what you guys like. And you mentioned in the video how you get these books, Stepien. Why don't you let our listeners know what your approach is for that?
No, I'm not sure I mentioned that, actually. I can't remember mentioning that.
I think you didn't you say something about, like, you get them around town? You just sort of look for
them? Those are called antiquariat in Croatian. It's basically an antique shop which only sells antique books. Secondhand books. I'm not sure if you have that in the States, but basically their business model is that they buy books of people who want to sell books, and then they sell them for a margin. And I will go around town, and most of those bookshop owners know me, and whenever a new chess book comes in, then they let me know. And I go by every shop once a week and see whether they got something I don't have yet. And I've bought a lot of books from one FIDE master, an elderly gentleman in Zagreb. He had a big collection and he sold it very cheaply to me. I bought around 100 books from him.
That's great. Yeah, and you mentioned that you want to build a library, so you're not discarding them when you're done.
No. I my dream is to have like a big chess room with 10 tables and shelves with lots of books and comfortable leather chairs for people to sit in and a bar or something and a pool table. I mean, yeah,
it's that sounds fantastic. Awesome. Is that included in the 9-year plan? Is that
No. That's after that.
Okay. Yeah, that does sound pretty nice. Okay. So I think we've gotten a good taste of your improvement philosophy. I have to say, Stjepan, you're an inspiring guy. I mean, the amount of work you're putting in and the systematic approach, I think, is something people can definitely benefit from.
Thank you.
It's pretty cool. But and I do want to talk about your YouTube channel a little bit, just because, you know, it seems like it's doing pretty well. So you're up to 9,000 subscribers. When or you know thereabouts? When did you launch the channel?
It was February 2018, a little more than a year ago, yeah.
Okay, and getting back to the other half of the question from Daniel Gell, and again, thanks for the support, Daniel, always appreciated. He says, I see that you have a successful YouTube channel owning in on 9,000 subscribers. What tips can you give for people who want to produce quality videos online to maintain growth and popularity? It looks simple, but I'm guessing that there's a lot of work involved behind the scenes.
I'm not really sure, but before I started the channel, I used to read a lot about YouTube and how it works. And I have to say my only goal was that I find something that is going to force me to study chess every day. So I took that approach and I didn't really consider too many things apart from that. So I wanted to create a channel because that would make me work on my chess every day, be it a new opening or whatever. And I think it takes dedication and love for the topic which you are covering. Obviously, if I were doing a channel about shoes, I would be unsuccessful and I couldn't do it. So you need to find the niche which you won't be upset about working on every day for 5 hours. And that would be my number one tip. If you find something that you like and you do a video a day, then you're going to be successful regardless of everything else.
And is that your goal, one video per day?
Yeah. Sometimes I really can't manage because of my work and everything else. But yeah, in general, I want to do one video a day. Yeah.
And you're spending a couple hours a day to produce them?
It will take me between 3 and 5 hours to make a video, depending on how long it takes me to prepare for the topic.
That's incredible. And I really like the thumbnails that you do. How did you come up with the design for your thumbnails?
Oh yeah, before I started the channel, I just hated that everybody has a chessboard and some random pictures.
Right.
In the thumbnails. I wanted to do something different, and my parents had bought me a chess set from the House of Staunton and a US shop. Anyway, they ordered the chess set when I finished college, and I have a beautiful Reykjavik set. So I wanted to do something with real pieces, and I didn't really want to do photos of a real board because I thought it would be too clustered and you couldn't really tell. So I chose a white background and took photos of pieces in the exact position which I'm covering in the video. And after that, after about a few months, they stopped being disgusting. And That's basically the idea. I wanted to take photos of my pieces on a white board and then just add stuff accordingly, depending on the topic.
Yeah.
I wanted it to be different than anything else that was out there.
Yeah. And I'm not a YouTube expert by any means, as anyone who listens to this podcast on YouTube can attest, because you know, this is audio only and I just have limited bandwidth, but I have gathered from watching a few YouTube videos here and there that stuff like the thumbnails and what you put in the titles is super important.
Well, yeah. I mean, you need to entice people to click on your video, obviously. And even though this is sort of a fanatic niche, and when people like chess, they like chess, and it won't really be important whether the video is good quality, the audio is good quality, or whether the thumbnail is ugly or nice. But you still need to entice the people that don't know about chess and don't know about your channel either. So if you're fighting for a click against somebody else, then you might as well have any advantage you could get.
Okay, and just out of curiosity, are there any, for anyone thinking of starting a YouTube channel and competing with you, would you dare give any recommendations, in terms of things that you were helpful to you in guiding you of how to start a successful channel?
if you mean resources, there are a couple of YouTube channels which helped me. There's one called YouTube Creators, Video Creators. There's a guy called Tim. I don't remember the last name. He basically covers all the technical stuff you need to know. And apart from that, nothing really. I try to approach a YouTube channel same as I approach everything else. And I created a plan and everything. And I schedule stuff. So that's the most helpful thing. You need to set aside time every day and be ready to commit yourself to doing it for 5 years at least, and that's it. All the technical stuff you can grasp within a day, and you will learn by doing. And my only tip would be that you start and you just record the video. If you listen to the first video I published, my microphone actually didn't work. The audio is really low, and I read from I had notes and I read, and you can hear that I'm reading, so the video is horrible, but I still put it out. And I think that the only way to improve is to actually make mistakes and get past them.
Yeah, that makes sense, as with chess. So what's your goal for the YouTube channel, if there is one?
Well, I don't have a goal subscriber-wise and anything else-wise. I basically want to cover every single opening and every single variation. I still have around 200 videos to go in that area. I want to cover all the major middle game topics, and then after I've done one of these, whichever is done first, I'm going to start an endgame series, and I want to analyze and cover all the major endgame positions, and I want to build a library for the beginner to intermediate player, and so that everybody can find whatever it is they're looking for. And I want to, well, I don't know about you or anybody else, but I like series, and once I find something I like, I want to have that apply to some other topic. So I thought it would be helpful to have everything in one spot and not have to browse around YouTube for a day to find something you like. So my goal is to finish an opening series, the middle game series, and the end game series, and to record my games online, because I found it to be very helpful when I lose and I analyze my game. It sort of makes me calmer and I'm not upset anymore. So my goal is to record my games, and that will force me to analyze them. And my goal is to make a library on YouTube. Yeah, that's it.
Wow. I mean, that's admirable, and you're certainly off to a good start. But I can't help but wonder, with time being such a scarce resource, I mean, with you being spread so thin, is it hard sometimes for you to put in the work on the YouTube video when I mean, forget all the other stuff you could be doing in life, but you could just be studying chess for those hours instead of creating content?
Yeah, but the other thing is that if I ever want to have 10 hours every day to study chess, I'm going to need to have money and I'm going to need to quit my job. So this is just a means to an end when you think about it. And I started the YouTube channel because I wanted to help people and I wanted to improve my chess, but I also found it to be a possible solution to my problem. And basically, the YouTube channel could be something that improves my chess along with creating a passive income, which could enable me to study chess the whole day. So it's always hard. I mean, it's always hard after a long day to record the video. But when I remember that I might just play chess every day, whole day, not have to worry about money and not have to do anything else, then it gives me the strength I need to continue.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, good for you. I mean, you're putting in the work, so hopefully you get the eyeballs that you deserve with that. I mean, and you're putting out a high quality product. Do you have ambitions to, if you were to someday be able to quit your job, do you have ambitions to do lessons, whether now or like when you're stronger, or are you more focused on the chess and the content creation?
Do you mean
teaching one-on-one stuff like that? Like, I mean, for example, if a listener wanted lessons from you now, first of all, would you be interested? And or one of your YouTube viewers, obviously, I'm sure you've gotten inquiries. And number two, is that something that's sort of in your business plan, or is that not your is teaching one-on-one not your favorite aspect of chess?
Well, I think I would like to do it, but if I didn't do it for money, because first of all, I really don't have time to commit to any schedule, and I can't really do that. And secondly, it's not really the most important thing I can do, because even though teaching somebody else will help you improve yourself, I think it would be much more valuable for me to pay for my own lessons and to do that. And I doubt that I will ever train other people.
Okay. All right. Just one or two more questions, Stjepan. One is, of course, I have to throw it out there that this would be totally unprecedented if you could pull off becoming a grandmaster. Do you find that being that vocal about a goal that lofty, do you find that daunting?
Well, I might be overconfident, but I think that being scared about what you want will only make you weaker. And even though most people, especially in Croatia, people I've met when I started playing chess didn't really take me serious, they don't still. I think that I can do it, and regardless of what everybody else thinks, it won't really influence the way I'm progressing. And I think that if a child can become a grandmaster between the ages of 5 and 12, then why couldn't I between the ages of 26 and 35? I really don't see a problem with that.
That's interesting. I mean, it would be chess history if you pull it off. I mean, and it does sound like if someone were going to do it, they would need to have an approach similar to yours. I mean, short of obviously if there's, you know, someone who just doesn't work, which, you know, obviously a few people are in that position where they don't have to work. Obviously, that would be a huge leg up. But short of that, I think it definitely requires the systematic approach that you're taking. So I'm definitely rooting for you. I mean, I have to say, I'm just going to be honest. I mean, I'd be amazed if you could pull it off. I would be surprised. But that doesn't mean that the journey isn't worth pursuing. And of course, I could be proven wrong.
Yeah, well, nobody can really say for sure, and it's going to be hard, and nobody knows how much effort or time it would take, but I'm not going to quit, and that's the only thing I care about. And
yeah, and of course, sorry, go ahead.
No problem.
Yeah, I was just going to say knowledge is its own reward, and I mean, what you've the strides you've made already are impressive, and, you know, any title, be it Canada Master, FIDE Master, International Master, I mean, they're all admirable, and they're all not easy to pull off when you're starting from scratch as a working adult.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think we're basically done, Stjepan. Often at the end, I'll ask what else people do in their free time, but I'm not sure if you have any. So, I mean, it doesn't seem like you're hitting the bars and the clubs very often based on your schedule.
I cook. I think that's my only hobby. I enjoy cooking, and I cook for my friends and family and everybody. So yeah, that's the only thing I do.
Yeah. What do you cook? Croatian food or food from all nationalities? What are your specialties?
I actually got a set of 10 different cookbooks, and I brought it to my office, and I told people that you could choose a thing I'm going to cook for lunch the next day. So I cook everything, whatever they choose.
Oh, that's awesome. Good for you. Cool. Was there anything else? I mean, we'll get your contact info in a second and link to your channel, obviously. But is there anything else you want to say before I let you get back to your busy life?
No, I just wanted to say thank you for having me. It's been great, and it's an honor to have you ask me to join your podcast. And I hope your podcast grows as well, and that you build an even bigger audience. I think what you're doing is extremely helpful to all levels of chess players, and keep up the great work.
Likewise. I mean, your videos are great, and your approach is inspiring. So. So yeah, and contact information. So I'll link to your YouTube channel, and your email address is on the channel. So do you mind if I put that in the show description?
You can put it. It's okay.
Yeah. Okay, and you're not on social media or anything, are you?
I've actually created social media accounts when I started my channel. I didn't really do anything on there because I have no idea how to. And about a week ago, I started posting stuff there. And now I have an Instagram account with 2 posts. And I have a Twitter account where I basically link my videos. I'm going to have to stop doing that. And I've created a Facebook page, which I don't think anybody can see. So if people want, they could join me there, but I'm going to try and figure out how they work and post some content.
Okay. Well, this comes out in a week, so you've got a week to decide if you want me to link to those. you just let me know. But yeah, thanks again. This was a lot of fun, and in a couple years, it'd be fun if you know. I have a feeling you still will be at it, so maybe we can get an update and see how you're doing.
Sure. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks to everyone who helps make Perpetual Chess possible. That includes my producer, Matthew Passy, and Geert Vandervelt for supplying the intro music. I also want to thank all of you who have helped spread the word about the show. That includes people who tell your friends and write positive reviews on Apple Podcasts or other platforms. Every little bit helps. But most of all, I want to thank the people who provide financial support. As you guys have heard me say, I spend a lot of time on this show, about 5 hours a week, and even though it's my favorite aspect of the work that I do, I would not be able to do all this without financial support. So most of all, I want to thank my Patreon and PayPal perpetual partners. They are Chessable.com, Ace Vallega, Adam Ralph of ChessEngland.com, Adam Vrancourge, Adrian Gutierrez, Alex Pejas, Benjamin Handelman, Brian Castro of BetterChessTraining.com, Bill Moran, Brett Howard Lynn, Brian Mullis, I am Carlos Perdomo of ChessAtlanta.com, Chad Hilton, Chad Oliver, Chris Balcom, Chris Flanagan, Chris Wainscott, Christopher Baumgartner, Christopher Chabri, Christopher Woods, I am Christoph Salicki, a.k.a. Chess Explained, Coach J's Chess Academy, Dan O'Hanlon, Daniel Gell, Daniel Ginsberg, Daniel Lucas, Daniel Naylor, Daniel Schaefer, Daniel Vine, David Cramley, Dwayne Edmonds, Ethan Smith, I am Alec Donnie Ariel, Frank Tortorice, M.D., Gary Andrews, Gary Lewis, Geert Vandervelt, Gerard Barta, Giovanni Russo, I am Greg Shahadi, Harish Srinivasan, GM Jakob Ogar, James Bonastia, Jason Woolham, Jeff Anderson, Jennifer Valens of OffTheRook.com, Jeffrey Martello, John Fernandez, John Fontaine, John Hartman, John Jernigan, WGM Jen Shahadi, Jens Green, Jerry Wells, John Thompson, Kare Christensen, WGM Katerina Nemsova, Kelly Palmer, I am Kostya Kovutsky, Krishna Gopala Krishnan, Laura Belyavsky, Lucio Casada Silva, Matthew Passy, Martin Habich, Matthew Tedesco, The Mysterious Moonmaster 9000, Mr. Mike Shahadi, Nate Salon, Nathan Webster, GM Pascal Charbonneau, Passy Passanen, Paul Bain, Paul Clarkson, Paul Sweeney, Paulo Santana, Peter Lux, Peter Merrifield, Quality Chess Books, Randall Temple, Ricky Grijalva, Rob Lazorchek of DiplomatChess.com, Robert Steiner, Ryan Stone, Scott Daugherty, Scott McKinnon, Steiner Lima, the Law Offices of Stuart Katz, WGM Tatyev Abrahamian, Thomas Casper, Thomas Stanix, Thomas Tachenko, Tim Brennan of TacticsTime.com, Tim Seymour, Timothy Ha, Todd Bryant, Tony Rotella, Tyron Price, Victor Vrancourge, FM Zhao Cheng, and Zhivko Stoyanov. Wow, the list is getting long. Let's keep getting it longer, guys. Thanks a lot, and I'll catch you all next week. Network.